This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What does social collapse look like? Manga Bay journalist Glenn Scherer relays the latest from Venezuela, including their reporters penetrating deep into the lawless Amazon. Our second trip this hour is guided by the prominent Harvard historian Serhii Plokhii. He grew up with the Chernobyl nuclear fright, lived through the following collapse, much deeper than the American Great Depression. Dr. Plokhii says the old Cold War manuals are back working for the Russian disinformation campaign against the Ukraine and against the United States. I'm Alex Smith. This is it, Radio EcoShock. When the economy collapses, would we still feed the rare animals in the zoo or eat them? That is just one of the real-time choices happening now in the South American country of Venezuela, as thousands flee that country and millions are hungry. The American government has just issued more sanctions following the troubled election of Presidente Nicolás Maduro. And from the capital Caracas to the Amazonian jungle, everything is in motion. Everything is on the table. Our guest, Glenn Scherer, is a contributing editor for the big environmental news site Manga Bay. Venezuela and Brazil are part of his beat, and Glenn has written for Scientific American, Salon, and many newspapers. He co-founded Blue Ridge Press, reaching tens of millions of people. Glenn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
I began with the zoo, and in this very strange story, I guess that's as good a place to start as any. What is happening at the zoo in Venezuela?
Well, what's happening at the zoos in Venezuela is what's been happening there since 2016. The economy has been in free fall since about 2014, one of the worst economic collapses in the Western Hemisphere ever in any country, probably the worst. And what you get when you have a collapse, and essentially a lot of analysts calling Venezuela now a failed state, it depends on how you define that, whether you say, yes, it's a failed state, what is the mark? But a country where the grocery store shelves are empty, there's no gasoline, which is strange in Venezuela, which is oil rich, but there's no gas. There's shortages of medicine, shortages of everything, and people are desperate. And poor people living around the zoos are raiding the zoos at night. They're eating anything they can get their hands on, monkeys, birds. Out in the wild, they're eating flamingos, endangered sea turtles, and, anything and everything. Not that we would do any different, I would imagine.
I think so. When I was living in Vancouver, I used to think, well, if the food truck stopped rolling, there's no warehouses here, those ducks in the park aren't going to last very long. But I have to ask, why did the food system collapse there? And are there lessons we could learn to avoid if our own economies stumble, which they will eventually?
Well, I'm not an economist, but from what I've read and what I understand and what our reporters have told us at Manga Bay, you had the Chavez Revolution, and it was very exciting, and he was pouring a lot into helping the poor and helping to raise all boats, so to speak. But he was doing it with the oil economy, and they were unable to diversify. He nationalized a lot of industry in 2006 and created a lot of alienation among international banks and big transnational companies and whatever you think of that. They tend not to invest if they're fearful they're going to be nationalized. So that hurt. And then, of course, 2014, the price of oil just plummeted and everything completely just went to hell in Venezuela. And on top of that, you had Maduro coming in and just really gross mismanagement of the crisis. They virtually did nothing except help the power elites, enrich the military, which in Venezuela, you've got a situation a lot like Egypt, where it's kind of a corporate military system where the military is heavily engaged in, gold mining down in the Amazon and highly responsible for a lot of the trafficking, like over 90% of the gold going out of Venezuela being exported is being done so illegally, and a lot of that's being trafficked by the Venezuelan army. So, it's gotten to be a pretty crazy situation. The mismanagement, the corruption, and the oil collapse all combining to just turn the world upside down for Venezuelans.
And what's happening with the currency? Does it still have some value? And how do people cope without any stable money and prices?
John Oliver had a sequence on Venezuela the other night, and they're no longer counting money. They weigh it.
Wow.
They've gone from 2,300% inflation. They're talking about 13,000% inflation this year. I mean, it's the worst in the world. And I mean, we're talking about Weimar Republic kind of inflation where we're wheelbarrows to buy a loaf of bread, that kind of stuff, wheelbarrows of money.
And Maduro, though, has suggested he's going to enter the 21st century with a petro-cryocurrency. What is that?
What it is, it's his version of Bitcoin, and it's going to be based on... it's very vague. It's very vague. It's supposed to be based on either the oil that they have still in the ground or the supposed $100 billion in mineral wealth in the Amazon. Now, of course, none of that mineral wealth has ever been certified. Nobody knows if it's really there. It's very hard to get at. And with the country crashing and violence at, you know, unprecedented levels, transnational companies, mining companies, et cetera, are very reluctant to invest there. So this whole idea of saving it through his petro-cryptocurrency is pretty bogus. Even, you know, he's got a great picture of himself holding this gold bar that's, you know, showing the strength of the Venezuelan natural resources, and nobody even knows where the gold in the bar came from. So, you know, the whole thing is smoke and mirrors by the looks of it.
And the BBC estimates that at least 5,000 people a day are leaving Venezuela, and surely business and all kinds of services must be kind of evaporating as people leave or don't show up for work if they're not going to be paid with money that's worth anything. What have you heard?
Well, one of our writers, Jean Freddy Gutierrez Torres, I've been in communication with him just the last couple of days. And speaking to him, he said essentially he's surviving on what he can make off the internet. And a lot of people that can do that are doing that. He's reporting for Munga Bay, and it's helping keep his family afloat. So a lot of people who are keeping their heads, I wouldn't say above water. I think the John Oliver reporting there saying people on average have lost over 20 pounds. The food shortages are very real, and the medicine shortages are very real, and so people are just getting by. Our reporter, John Freddy, just bought a car. He said almost nobody has cars, or cars that are running because it's hard to get gas. His car that he bought was a 2001 car, and he said it's great because he doesn't have to ride in the open trucks anymore to do his reporting because people are riding around the back of these open trucks, and if there's an accident, he said just 12 people were killed like a couple weeks ago in his city riding the back of these open trucks. That's your bus service.
We've seen TV footage of desperate Venezuelans pouring over the border to Colombia, which is not a rich state either. But Glenn, you say some Colombians are going the other way. What's going on there?
Well, what you have is this free-for-all happening in Amazonia State and Bolivar State in the south and the west, the Amazonian part of Venezuela. And that's along the Brazilian border and the Colombian border. And what's happening in Colombia is some of the rebels who were involved over there, now that, you know, there's been a peace treaty signed and things are getting a little quieter. Maybe rebels isn't the right word. In this case, thugs might be a better word. And they're armed thugs, and they're moving over the border into Venezuela and getting into the mining business, which is very popular, except you got to compete with the Venezuelan army and maybe the Venezuelan state police or the intelligence service, and then the National Guard is involved. And You know, John Freddy, or no, actually Bram Ebus in the Dutch reporter who went to the Orinoco mining arc, this southern area in the Amazon where all these minerals are. He was actually held prisoner, by the way, for 24 hours. Very scary. He was held by the National Guard. They had no idea his team was held in a warehouse at gunpoint, not told what was happening. 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, they threw him in the back of a pickup truck and rode him out into the middle of nowhere, dumped him out, and let him go. So that's the kind of things that are happening. And these various groups are competing with each other. They hire small-scale miners to do gold mining for them. They're trafficking in the gold. There's a lot of competition between Venezuelan army officers and even retired army officers, from what Bram reported to us from Mungabe. So that's the situation down in the south there. Bram said you cannot ride 30 minutes without a roadblock, an armed roadblock, and you don't know who's going to be in the roadblock or what their game is going to be, or, you know, bribes. And everybody's hungry, everybody's looking for a way to make ends meet, and everybody, and you know, if you've got a gun, you have a leg up.
Well, my hat's off to the Dutch journalist Bram Ebus for getting down there and getting a firsthand look of what's going on. I mean, from my distance, I've seen documentaries in the mining in the Amazon showing barrels and barrels of toxic chemicals and mercury flushed into the streams and rivers as part of the process. Have you heard about that as well?
Well, you know, Mungabe is, well, we're certainly interested in social issues, but we're largely an environmental news reporting site. And that's one of the things we're really interested in. I mean, what's happening is these wildcat mines that are opening up. I mean, okay, so in a failed state, environmental regulations are being completely ignored. They're not being enforced. As you said, toxic waste is going right into streams. They're digging into riverbanks. They're mining for, you know, placer deposits in the streams. Tremendous amounts of sediments. They use mercury to purify the gold, which is, of course, extremely toxic. They're eating whatever they can eat, so they're eating wildlife. They're invading national parks. One of the stories John Freddy did, now this was in the north or in the west of the country, not in the Amazon itself, on the edge of the Andes, the Caparo Forest Reserve. Now, this is managed by one of the universities in Venezuela. It's an experimental station, a forestry station, you know, much like we have here in the United States that Harvard might operate or something like that. And that was just invaded by 200 farmers, and you can't blame the farmers, really. They're hungry. They lack land. They invaded this. This is one of the last forest remnants there, and they've taken it over, and the university is protesting to the government, and the Maduro government is doing virtually nothing, has done nothing to help. They're holding street protests, the university is, to try and get some action, but so far just nothing. Again, nothing's happened. So what you get is this situation of chaos and confusion and lawlessness. And also, you know, I don't want to paint a totally negative scene. One of the things John Freddy told me about is that how people are all getting together to help each other. He's going to be reporting soon in July on an indigenous reserve there that has opened up itself to the surrounding communities. They've got schools. The surrounding communities are trying to supply, give them school supplies. They're making their own medicine on the reserve, you know, from herbal medicines and things like that, that they're getting out of the forest. So people are doing what they do when the government leaves a vacuum. They're finding ways to live and thrive, or at least survive.
Well, hold that positive thought. You are tuned to the Global Environment on Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. My guest is journalist Glenn Scherer from mongabay.com. You've talked about some of the positive roles for the indigenous people, but I'm willing to bet that it isn't all good news when this amount of desperation comes into their living space.
Well, again, our reporters, Bram Ebus did a story for us on the impacts in the mining arc in the Amazon on indigenous preserves and indigenous communities. And, you know, okay, so you've got this tremendous inflation rate. The indigenous people do buy food, they do buy medicine, they need supplies. A lot of the people are going off the land, and, you know, you're desperate for food. You hear about a gold strike 50 miles, 100, 200 miles away. Off you go. Take your gold pan and go. And the next thing you know, you're working for the military, which is operating illegally, but, you know, operating an illegal gold mine, or you're working for just an organized group of thugs with guns. And it's really close to slavery in a lot of cases. People working with malaria, people working, you know, obviously hungry. Disease levels are high. You know, you go back in some ways to the mining boom days in the U.S. in the 1800s, the lawlessness, the disease, prostitution, all the basic problems that you get in a boom town. And there are these boom towns all over the mining arc where, you know, it's small-scale miners being harnessed to these groups of thugs. And what's scary is this isn't just happening in Venezuela. This is, I mean, you can find this in Democratic Republic of Congo. You can find this around the world in places where, remote places where law is failing, where you've got economic tailspins going on. So the situation for indigenous people is akin to ethnocide, as one of the people that one of the experts Bram interviewed, Bram Ebus, the Dutch reporter, said it's equivalent to ethnocide because, you know, not only are the people leaving their communities, they're leaving behind their traditions, they're leaving behind their livelihoods, of their farming communities. Fishing communities, you know, how do you fish when the rivers are being polluted by toxic mine waste? It's not a good situation. It's pretty serious.
And further south in the Amazon, the Brazilian government has gone back and forth about enforcing protection of the rainforest, which has been called the lungs of the planet. It's essential to the functioning of global nature, to even the hydrological system. Will the distraction of a wave of Venezuelan immigrants weaken the overall protection of that great Amazon rainforest?
Well, the protections aren't as great as we would hope they would be or maybe think they should be. You know, here in the U.S., there were cries to protect the Amazon against the soy growers, and you know, the soy moratorium was highly successful. There were efforts to cut back beef production. But the truth is the ruralists, the agribusiness industry, and that includes the big commodity companies which support it, Bunge and Cargill and, you know, all the big global commodities companies, all of that is transpiring to slowly eat away, and not so slowly in a lot of places, at the Amazon. And so the Amazon is in very serious trouble. We just did some very important scientific reporting. Tom Lovejoy did a piece for us, and Carlos Nobre, another Brazilian scientist, and they wrote a commentary for us. They estimate that Brazil is somewhere around maybe 2 or 3% deforestation away, Amazon deforestation from a tipping point. And nobody knows exactly where that tipping point is. But when that tipping point comes, the climate shifts, and a lot of the Amazon rainforest, certain sections of it, will automatically be receiving less rainfall. And when that happens, you're suddenly going to see deforestation on its own. We won't have to cut down the trees. They'll just die. And you're going to transform the rainforest to savanna. And there goes your lungs, you know, and you're now that guy in the hospital who's been smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, and your lungs are going. So it's a very serious situation there. The Temer government, the administration in power, is loaded with people, ruralists, these agribusiness people who see nothing. they're very interested in profits and really have very limited vision in terms of the environment. And, you know, it's a similar problem that we suffer. You know, can't blame the Brazilians. It's very similar to what's going on with Trump in the U.S. and the EPA. Very difficult issues where how do you talk to people? How do you get people around a table when they're thinking profits and raising all boats like they did in Venezuela with the economy? They're raising mostly the boats for the elites. How do you deal with that? But when you're at this brink where 2 or 3% more deforestation and you could hit this tipping point, not only is that a disaster for the Amazon, that's a disaster for agribusiness. You know, the aquifers are already extremely stressed by soy, corn, cotton in the Cerrado and the Amazon, two of the major regions for agriculture. And you change it's already changing. The amounts of rain are falling. The droughts are getting much, much worse. And you're looking at an agribusiness collapse, and you have an agribusiness collapse which just went into number one spot for soy production, as one of the largest beef producers in the world, has a big corn and cotton market, and that collapses. That's a lot of hungry Chinese people. That's a lot of hungry people in the European Union. It's a serious situation there. And then you've got the pressure from Venezuela. Now, that's not as big an issue, but you've got people pouring in from Venezuela and destabilizing the border areas in Brazil. Brazil sent in the army to help manage it. The truth is, I think this is not just a Venezuelan problem. I wrote a final piece at the end of the series by Bram Ebus. He did three stories, and I'm just going to read the last paragraph. Unfortunately for the world, Venezuela's Arco Mineral isn't a one-off. Similar scenarios are playing out to a lesser or greater degree in struggling and failing nations like Honduras, Democratic Republic of Congo, the Philippines, and across South America, Africa, and Asia. With intense civil unrest met by repression and violence, extreme exploitation by extraction industries, and agribusiness aided by corrupt government, escalating ecosystem and climate disasters, and ongoing suffering by indigenous, traditional, impoverished peoples. In truth, the narrative of the failing state seen today in Venezuela could be shaping up to be one of the 21st century's biggest political, social, and environmental stories.
So what is Info Amazonia, and how can we use that resource?
Oh, Info Amazonia is a tremendous resource. Bram Ebus, I should have mentioned this early on, he originally was working with them and I believe the Pulitzer Center to produce a very big story, 10,000 words, on the mining arc. And Bram contacted us and said, hey, do you want to be in on this? So we jumped in and worked with them, produced the stories we produce. Info Amazonia does some tremendous documenting of the environmental problems. And for people interested in seeing, they do tremendous maps, infographics, video, all kinds of really wonderful reporting on what's going on in the Amazon. And I really recommend it to you listeners. It's a terrific place. And, of course, I recommend Munga Bay, too. It's important to everyone, not just to Brazilians or Venezuelans, but to the world, as you said, the lungs of the world. And if we don't preserve the Amazon, it's going to quicken climate change in ways that we're already in over our heads with climate change, and it could put us even deeper.
Well, again, I'm beyond my expertise, but I believe I spoke with a guest who was explaining that the cloud forest of the Amazon was actually a key factor for rainfall in Africa, where millions and millions of people depend on rain-fed agriculture.
You know, I'm working on a possible story right now, how the Arctic influences the tropics. So all of these regions, the tropical rainforest belt around the Earth, Indonesia, Africa, in Central Africa, and in Latin America, are all influencing our weather, all shaping the planet, and, you know, not even to mention the massive amounts of biodiversity, the medicines that come out of these plants and these forests, the wealth of just, you know, spectacular animals and beauty I mean, we don't talk about that enough, and the spiritual meaning of these places and how they nurture human beings. We have a lot to lose if we lose these places. We'll lose our planet and lose ourselves.
You've hit it. We've been speaking with journalist Glenn Scherer. He publishes widely while a contributing editor for Manga Bay. You could start with his article, Venezuela, Can a Failing State Protect Its Environment and Its People? I'll put links to follow up in my own show blog, of course, at ecoshock.org. But you should keep track of the World Environment Beat at news.mangabay.com. Glenn, thank you so much for giving us this update.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
And now, before giving you the details, I bring you a warning. Every one of you listening, tell the world. Tell this to everybody wherever they are.
On April 26, 1986, a young professor was returning to teach at his university in the Ukraine when there was a terrible accident at the Chernobyl nuclear reactor. But the Soviet government hid it while millions of people were exposed to dangerous levels of radioactivity. Some argue the Chernobyl reactor accident and the government cover-up might have helped the downfall of the Soviet Union and the independence of Ukraine. Did it also derail expansion of the nuclear industry and turn Russia toward climate-killing fossil fuels instead? We need to know, and Professor Serhii Plokhii has written the definitive book. It is simply called Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. This is the most recent of 12 books by Plokhii about the Ukraine, Eastern Europe, and the Cold War. Serhii Plokhii is now an American and an esteemed professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University. Serhii, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to talk to you and through you to your listeners.
It's 32 years now, a generation since Chernobyl reactor blew up. What was the cause of that first big nuclear accident that affected the globe?
Well, the immediate cause was the turbine test that went terribly wrong. The explosion of the reactor and meltdown of its core came out as a result of the mistakes and violations of the safety procedures that were committed by the operators of the reactor. But the consequences would be not so terrible and devastating if the reactor itself wouldn't have all sorts of issues and problems, safety issues and problems. So the design of the reactor was bad. And on the top of that, the Soviets had two type of reactors, one of them more safer ones they were exporting to the countries of Eastern Europe, less safer one they were using within the Soviet Union itself. And it was exactly that less safer type of a reactor, RBMK, water graphite reactor, that exploded.
According to your book, Soviet scientists had already circulated a paper warning about the exact circumstances leading to such an explosion in the RBMK reactor design. If that danger was known, how did it still happen?
For the first time, they experienced that kind of problems in 1975. So more than 11 years before the Chernobyl explosion. It took place at the nuclear power plant near the city that at that time was called Leningrad. Now it's St. Petersburg. And they eventually, after that, issued all sorts of instructions, some of how the operators should behave themselves, how they should continue with their work, and also recommendations on the improvement of the reactor. But very little was really done, and it was the atmosphere of secrecy. So what happened at Leningrad nuclear power plant stayed basically, it was a state secret. Also from the operators of the same kind of reactors outside of Leningrad. And one of the reasons for that, again, was the atmosphere of secrecy. Another was that the academic advisor to the group that designed the reactor was at that time the head of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, Anatoly Alexandrov. He was also the director of the Soviet Institute of Nuclear Energy Industry that were involved in that, yeah.
Right now in America, there are about 23 General Electric Mark I reactors running, and they all have the same flawed design demonstrated at four blown reactors in Fukushima, Japan. Now, American regulators and operators know the design is inherently unsafe, and yet they still keep running them. Did the same thing happen with those badly designed RBMK reactors after Chernobyl? Did the Soviets keep their reactors going?
Absolutely. Even after Chernobyl, they couldn't just replace the RBMK reactor, so they went for all sorts of changes and adjustments. But again, the reactors were there, and the last Chernobyl reactor was shut down only in 1999. So the reason for that is, of course, that it's extremely costly to shut down the reactor or replace it. And that happens over time. And then the industry, of course, is invested in keep the reactors going, whether that puts at risk the population at large or not. So we deal with very different political regimes, with very different countries. But the logic behind the industry operating still the reactors that are not considered to be safe is more or less the same.
An important deputy administrator in Soviet nuclear operations named Valery Legasov said, "It is safe to say that nuclear power is considerably less harmful to human health than coal power." We still hear that argument today. Serhii, what do you think?
Today, many people consider that nuclear power is the way to deal with the climate change crisis. And indeed, as long as nuclear reactors operated the way how the designers want them to operate, everything is good and cool and clean. But if something happens, if something bad happens, it's really bad. And again, we have so far three major accidents at the nuclear power plants. One of them, number one, it's Chernobyl in terms of the amount of the radiation released. Number two is Fukushima. And number three is the Three Mile Island accident that took place here in this country, in the United States, in the late 1970s. Chronologically, that was the first one. So we are dealing with three different countries, different sets of circumstances. But again, one of the conclusions from looking at that is that, okay, the nuclear energy is not really safe, and you have to be super careful in the way how you approach the development of the nuclear energy in the future.
In what sense do you say the Chernobyl nuclear disaster was a result of, quote, a militarized economy?
Well, what you see, and this is true, that was certainly true for the Soviet Union and for the United States. First, you see the development of the nuclear arms, so atomic bomb and then hydrogen bomb. And in the Soviet case, it's the same people who were designing the atomic bomb. They're designing the reactors as well. To a degree, the same story in the United States, where President Eisenhower launches in December of 1953 this program, Atoms for Peace, basically to somehow deal with the fear of nuclear arms that is spreading in the United States, but also in Europe. So there is a close connection between the atoms for war and atoms for peace. And in the Soviet case, that relation was particularly because here in the United States, it's private companies that run reactors and the government has responsibility of overseeing them. In the Soviet Union, the government owned the reactors, the government was running the reactors, and the government was policing itself. And as a result of that, they were cutting all sorts of corners. They, for example, didn't build the containment over the reactor, something that is standard procedure here in this country. Again, the reactors that they had, they were twice as powerful and cheaper to build than safer reactors, so-called water-water reactors that also were used and are used in the United States of America. So, again, the connection was in both cases, but again, in the Soviet situation, it was especially dangerous. What you see now, it's a different kind of relationship, because countries, especially in the Middle East, especially when you look at Iran or India before that, they get the nuclear reactors as the backdoor to then acquiring nuclear weapons. That presents a danger in its own right, in a sense. Again, those countries are not particularly interested in running those reactors. They're interested in acquiring technology that would allow them to build the bomb.
Do you think that modern governments in the Ukraine and Russia differ in their views and uses of the historical fact of Chernobyl?
Well, they are very different. And the three countries that suffered the most from Chernobyl, the first would be Belarus. So proportionally, a much larger part of its territory was affected, a larger part of the population was affected, then goes Ukraine, and then goes Russia. And in Ukraine, the Chernobyl became a major issue that led eventually to the independence of the country. And the country adopted the most liberal laws in terms of defining the so-called sufferers, people who were affected by the disaster and are receiving, still receiving all sorts of subsidies from the state. In Belarus, they couldn't go this route because, again, the percentage of people affected was so high. So there is a tendency of kind of a maybe diminish the impact of Chernobyl. Ukraine is asking for international attention, for international subsidy, for international inspections when Belarus is not doing that. And Russia today is back on its feet as a nuclear superpower in more than one way. And building, there are nine reactors now under construction in Russia. And Russia also exports nuclear technology to other countries of the world, Iran in particular. So again, the trajectories that these three countries that were part of the Soviet Union and were affected by Chernobyl, trajectories that they're taking today are very different.
You have a distinguished list of works on the history of the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. Why did you choose to devote a whole book to Chernobyl, and why now?
One thing is that Chernobyl is part of my own as, again, I was living in Ukraine at that time. Some of my friends and colleagues were drafted into the army and sent to Chernobyl. The same happened to some of my students at the university. So it's really a very important part of my own life. And I wanted for quite a while to go back and look and try to understand what happened there. And recent developments in Ukraine, the protest at Maidan, the Revolution of Dignity, resulted also in what I call an archival revolution. The formerly classified files from KGB, the state agencies, now became available and open, and I really seized that opportunity. Working with those materials, and many of them ended up in the book and would be KGB safety issues at the nuclear power plant. There would be also KGB reports about surveillance of the foreigners, Americans, in a National Geographic team that came to Ukraine to write about Chernobyl. So it's really fascinating materials that I was able to get access to.
Talk to us about the role of the American doctor Robert Peter Gale.
Well, he was the first probably American who came to the Soviet Union after the nuclear disaster at Chernobyl, and he came to help. His specialty has been, I don't know whether he still operates, but a surgeon, and he operated on bone marrow. And he operated on quite a few people, in particular firefighters, who are affected the most by the radiation, because one of the things that happens is that bone marrow is affected. And he operated on those people. The problem was that most of them died after that. Again, there were all sorts of coverage of those operations, both in the Soviet media and then in the United States, whether the procedures were really approved and acceptable. and what caused the death. So the situation is that people were really affected in a very bad way, and probably operation could save life, some of them, but not others. So in the long term, what he did became quite controversial. But at the moment, that was, he sent a very positive signal in a sense that it was still in the middle of the Cold War, that the United States was there to help. And I remember my own reaction when, again, his visit to the Soviet Union, his operations that he conducted were covered in the Soviet media. I really felt good about that. I thought that that was a positive sign of cooperation, but also that help was coming to my countrymen at that time. Like many things at Chernobyl, it's very easy to put just pluses or just minuses on somebody's activities, but I think at that moment it was a sign of hope, I would say.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Serhii Plokhii, the American author, historian, and specialist in the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. His new book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe, is the most complete account published so far, I think. Dr. Plokhii grew up and was educated in the Ukraine when it was part of the Soviet Union. Did American intelligence know about Chernobyl accident before the Swedes at Forsmark warned the world about it?
Well, it looks like not just little, but nothing. It was the Swedes who sounded the alarm the first. They thought that something was wrong at one of their nuclear power plants and only later realized that things went wrong on the other side of the Iron Curtain in the Soviet Union. We have the today declassified CIA reports, and the first of them comes from April 29th of 1986, so basically more than 3 days after the accident. And most of the information that CIA had would come really from the satellites. On the basis of that, the estimate and the projection of what that could mean for the development of the Soviet economy or for the development of the Soviet society. The assessments were quite conservative in that sense. I can't say that they were out of place or that they were wrong, but the information was really very limited. Because of that, for example, some reports that appeared in Western media were claiming that there were thousands of people who were killed, the entire area is completely devastated, and the Soviets seized on that later, saying that, okay, there is a Cold War propaganda, and the information, it was still a Cold War there, the information was really limited.
Meanwhile, the number of reactors in America has continued to shrink. Do you think the Chernobyl disaster signed the death warrant for expanding nuclear power in the United States?
Well, certainly after Chernobyl, what you see is that quite a few countries take a pause on whether they should continue, whether they should develop nuclear energy or not. And Chernobyl, for example, mobilized the anti-nuclear opposition. The Greens became very, very strong in Western Germany in particular. It had less impact, for example, on France, which continues till today to go nuclear and be very optimistic about the development of nuclear energy. 80% of all electricity produced in France comes from nuclear, as opposed to 20%. Roughly 20% in the United States. So each time you have an accident like Chernobyl and then Fukushima, there would be a major impact on the nuclear industry and development of nuclear industry. The Japanese are trying to get out of nuclear today. Germans certainly are on the time, it looks like, with their program of becoming nuclear free. What goes against the nuclear energy here in this country is, of course, that the shale gas revolution, that it became so big and cheap, and from that point of view, nuclear energy is quite expensive. So you see a number of filing for bankruptcy of major companies working in the nuclear energy here in the United States, including Westinghouse. So partially this is a result of a shale gas revolution. But there are also other tendencies and other voices that can change this trajectory in the future, and it is related to the growing concern about climate change. For example, in France, some major money is being poured back again into the nuclear energy with the hope that, again, concerns about climate change will change also the attitude toward nuclear energy. So we are not sure yet what will happen in the future. But what we know and for sure is that the center of the construction of nuclear reactors is moving away from U.S. and from Western Europe. So China today is building 21 nuclear reactors. Russia, I mentioned already, 9. Other countries in the Middle East. So that's the tendency, and that is also a worrisome tendency in a sense that in some of those places, nuclear energy, much of expertise, you deal with the first generation nuclear engineers, like it was the case in the Soviet Union during Chernobyl. So the safety of the nuclear industry is certainly concerned in the quote-unquote first world, in North America and in Western Europe, but it's twice as much a concern in the new frontier for the nuclear energy.
As you mentioned, I've seen widely different estimates of fatalities attributable to the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, from millions of deaths to just 10. Serhiy Plokhiy, what is the truth you were able to uncover?
Well, almost everyone agrees that the direct deaths related to Chernobyl, there are 31 people who died. So two of them died as a result of the explosion per se. One engineer was just crushed by the fallen structures. Another got burned by super hot steam. And those were deaths within 1 or 2 days. And then in the next few weeks, 29 people died because of the exposure to the radiation. That's where certainty ends. After that, we are talking about the impact, the radiation impact that might have shortened people's lives. And there the estimates are anywhere between 6,000 to 90,000. Again, we don't know for sure. What we know is that there was a major, a very dramatic spike in the number of thyroid cancer cases among children. So all the way between 4,000 and 6,000 additional cases, additional on the top of what normally occurs in the population of that demographic category. I understand that, again, all those cases were detected at time, children were treated and so on and so forth, but again, that spike we know for sure. One of the reasons why it is difficult to say is that soon after Chernobyl, you, of course, have the disintegration of the Soviet Union. You have a very difficult economic times in the 1990s, so something that makes the depression of the 1920s and 1930s like dwarf compared to the kind of hardships that were in that region. And in that sense, it was very difficult to follow the trajectories of people who were at Chernobyl. Altogether, 600,000 people, mostly men, were drafted mostly through the army and sent to Chernobyl. And the allowed dose of radiation that they got was a 25 rentgen. This is 5 times as much as was before the accident, the permissible dose before the accident that was supposed to be taken within 1 year. Here people were getting that within maybe a few days or within a few weeks. So the impact, everyone knows that the impact on the population is there, but it's difficult to estimate exactly what that impact was.
Did anyone go to jail because of the historic accident?
Yes, absolutely. So the key manager, the plant, were put on trial 1 year after the accident. And the director, the chief engineer, and deputy chief engineer, the deputy chief engineer was the one who was running the test, 10 years imprisonment. All of them were already suffering from the radiation poisoning. So they eventually were released before the end of their sentences by 1991. Who wasn't really punished in that way were the people responsible for the design of the reactor. So two key figures were just quietly retired after the accident. One of them was the president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, Mr. Alexandrov. I mentioned his name before. And another was the uncrowned king of the Soviet nuclear industry, Yefim Slavsky, who, again, was retired after the accident in the fall of 1986. There were never any charges put against them. In Ukraine, they put charges against the leaders of Ukraine at that time for the cover-up, but again, nobody there went to prison.
Now, half of all the electricity generated in the Ukraine is from 15 nuclear reactors in the country as we speak. So do polls show that the people in the Ukraine now accept nuclear power as a safe option?
Well, this is a great question, because what happened in Ukraine immediately after Chernobyl was basically the complete revolt against nuclear power. The parliament passed the law in 1990, even before the collapse of the Soviet Union, stipulating that by 1995, all the reactors were supposed to be closed. But then came the 1990s, this deepest possible depression and recession. And the country began to rely on nuclear energy even more than it relied during the Soviet times. So there was a complete reversal. The very same people, the very same parliament that voted for outlawing, so to speak, nuclear energy, now embraced nuclear energy, and it continues still today. So in Ukraine, you see the eco-nationalism kind of being replaced with nuclear nationalism, in a sense that any suggestions coming from the West that it is unsafe is considered to be as kind of an encroachment on the sovereign rights of the state and nation.
The politics of the Ukraine and their relationships with Russia are blowing back into American politics now, with Robert Mueller's investigation and Paul Manafort's relationship to Ukraine and Russia. And I'd like to touch, therefore, a little on your other work. When I try to understand that complicated relationship between Ukraine and Russia today, I still go back to the book The Harvest of Sorrow by Robert Conquest. And even today, I wonder whether people believe the great killer starvation that happened in 1932 and 33 was ordered by Stalin, or was it an accidental famine. That belief could determine how Ukrainians think and feel about Russia. Do you agree, or have we escaped that history?
Well, we didn't. And today, the majority of population in Ukraine believe that the Ukrainian famine was a genocide perpetrated not against necessarily ethnic Ukrainians, but against the people of Ukraine as a whole of different ethnic backgrounds. In Russia, and in particular the Russian government, is actually very strongly opposed to the interpretation of the famine in Ukraine, which is called Holodomor, as the act of genocide. And it's a big, big problem when it comes not just to the interpretation of history, but also to the international relations, which became especially acute now in the context of this conflict and Russian-Ukrainian war, annexation of the Crimea, the continuing war in eastern Ukraine. So there are a number of historical narratives that clash with one another. The Chernobyl interpretation of Chernobyl is not kind of in the center of this wars of history. But actions, the military actions, actually are a factor, because last year, in August of the last year, the monitoring equipment that is in Chernobyl was disabled by the spread of one of the viruses, the computer virus. Ukrainian and the American experts pointed finger at Russia at that point. So again, history is very much on the line in the conflict that is going on in Ukraine and around Ukraine today. But Crimean Peninsula, the question of who has right for Crimea, again, it is very deeply rooted also in history.
Let me read you one ironic statement in Wikipedia discussing the denial of Holodomor. It says, the denial of the man-made famine was a highly successful and well-orchestrated disinformation campaign by the Soviet government. And that phrase, well-orchestrated disinformation campaign, sounds so familiar it reminds us of the recent Russian effort to get Donald Trump elected instead of Hillary Clinton. So it makes me wonder, how much has Russia really changed away from that old Soviet fear of the rest of the world?
I would say that some people in Russia today reach out to the manuals from the Cold War era. And you mentioned that orchestrated campaign regarding the denial of Holodomor. It wasn't the question of interpretation, but there was the denial that anything of that nature happened. The book that was sponsored back then by the Soviet Union had a version of something about, the subtitle read, From Hitler to Harvard. And Harvard was mentioned there because the Institute of Ukrainian Research Institute that I director now was helping Robert Conquest to write the book on the Harvest of Sorrow. So in that sense, this is probably the best example of this campaign, international campaign, to discredit in a particular type of understanding of history, or even generally writing about elements of Soviet history that were not perceived positively by Kremlin. And today we have the same story again when it comes again either to Ukrainian famine, to Holodomor, or to the history of the Second World War. So again, it looks like that the old manuals are back in demand in those libraries in Russian government, maybe Russian foreign ministry.
Where will future historians rank Chernobyl? Is it in the top 10 or top 100 events of the modern age?
Well, I certainly would say that it's in the top maybe 10 events today, given the importance of nuclear power in general and how dangerous it is. And I wish that it would stay really high there as a warning to the society. And also, if it is up there, that means that we avoid in the future accidents like that, because the worst-case scenario, there would be more Chernobyls after that. And our perception of how important the Chernobyl of 1986 was would change. So I hope it stands quite high and as a warning to the future generations.
Serhii, your career is long and deeper than most readers. What are you working on next?
Well, I mentioned already this archival revolution that took place in Ukraine, and one of the set of documents, formerly secret, that became available, those were the surveillance files of the Red Army, Soviet Army counterintelligence units. And they were in particular surveilling the three American air bases that I don't know whether your listeners heard about that or not, but there were three American air bases behind Soviet lines, Stalin's lines, in Ukraine in 1944-1945. Those were bases for so-called shuttle bombing, where the American airplanes were flying from the bases in United Kingdom and in Italy, and then were landing on the Ukrainian airfields, refueling, getting new bombs, and going back over Eastern Europe and Central Europe and bombing German targets. So the story is kind of known from the American sources and from the American side, but now we have more than 20 volumes of this secret surveillance of the American bases, and I'm trying to integrate those files into a story that we already know and see what happened there. And one of the preliminary conclusions that I have is that the Cold War really starts earlier than we believe it started. You see already very serious tensions during World War II between the Americans and certainly the Soviet regime. And the reason for that foundation is that many in the American ranks, they are not necessarily ideologically hostile to the Soviet Union. Many of them are left-leaning. Many of them, their families come from the region, but they can't accept the atmosphere of the police state in which they found themselves. They can't accept duplicity. They can't accept the kind of the form of authoritarian dictatorial regime that they're dealing with. And Soviet, at the beginning, leave the bases with very, very strong concern about the future of relations between the United States and Soviet Union. So it's a fascinating story.
We have been speaking with Dr. Serhiy Plokhii, author and Harvard professor specializing in the history of the Ukraine. His latest book is bound to become a reference about the world's second largest nuclear accident, some now say, in Chernobyl, Ukraine. The book is not dry. It is a lively combination of stories with irony and pathos. Look for Chernobyl, the History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. I'll put links to follow up on this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Professor Plokhii, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. It was a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. That is the end of the line for this week. Please tune in again next week for stunning climate science from NASA. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.